John Guernsey. It's very difficult for me to think of an introduction for John Guernsey, and the main reason is that he is my friend, and all the superlatives about John and his great gifts have been used so often that it's difficult for me to introduce him in just the right way. I could certainly speak to his high academic achievement at Yale University, certainly in his days at seminary. I could tell you how many churches he has assisted, how many dioceses he has assisted, how often the National Church has called upon John for help, how often I have called upon John for help. I think the simplest thing that I could say, which in fact is the best thing for me, is that the great gift John brings to us is his love of the Lord and his clear explanation of how we can be better stewards. We are very privileged to have John in the Diocese of Virginia, and it is with great joy that I turn over the morning to the Reverend John A.M. Guernsey.
Thank you, Barbara. I find it exciting, if not somewhat disconcerting, to be in a situation of directly ignoring the counsel and direction of our Lord, who warned us that a prophet is not without honor except in his own country. I find it a bit safer to contemplate going to the now renowned Diocese of North Carolina in 2 months to do a workshop very much like this. And our bishop has given me advice and counsel about that. It is exciting to be here because I've had the opportunity to work in a number of your congregations doing stewardship teaching, and it's an opportunity for me to try to draw together a great deal of what I've learned in your vestry rooms and in your parish halls and after church suppers and all of that, because we're here to share some things today out of the experience of our diocesan stewardship committee. I'm going to talk in the next 40 minutes or so about some biblical principles, some theological truths about stewardship, and then after the break to come back and try to talk about some ways in which we can put those principles into practice in some practical principles for our own congregations. Let me make it very clear, though I would have said this even before the bishop had to leave, that we are not here today to raise money for the diocesan budget. We are not in the fundraising business, and you may relax at that notion. The downside of that is that we're not here to raise money for your church budget either. And if anyone needs to leave now, that's all right. If you came here because the roof was leaking, well, I think, though, you will find the day productive. Because it's our conviction that if the focus is on commitment to Jesus Christ, the dollars will take care of themselves. And I think that that is probably the most important principle in what we're about here. Our focus is on our commitment and, as the bishop said, our trust of the Lord, and trying to find ways that we can live that out day in and day out, ways that we can implement the need for education in our parishes that don't in fact undermine the theology that we have, things that put into practice our faith in Jesus Christ and don't subvert it. So I want to get right at it. I want to talk in the first session about some biblical principles and some basic understandings of Christian stewardship. And I'll give you some biblical references and read them to you. You might want to take them down and look them up later at your leisure.
Is there anything we can do about Van Halen?
That's the children rehearsing upstairs, so we will have both going on. First is Deuteronomy 8, 17 and 18. Moses is leading the people of Israel through the wilderness. They've come out of Egypt, they're in the wilderness, and they're on their way to the promised land. And they have, of course, been slaves and have had next to nothing by way of possessions. And Moses speaking for God, is preparing the people of Israel for the prosperity that they are going to have once they cross over the Jordan River into the Promised Land, a prosperity they've never known before. And consequently, there's a great deal of stewardship teaching in the book of Deuteronomy as they anticipate dealing with wealth and possessions. And Moses, speaking for God, looking ahead to their life in the Promised Land and the land of milk and honey, says, "Beware lest you say in your heart, 'My might and the power of my hand have gotten me this wealth.' You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth." Which, as a biblical statement, is probably as bald a contradiction of what we hear day in and day out in this culture as you could hope to find. Our society says, "This is my money. I earned it." You know, the old-fashioned way, "I earned it." That, therefore, it is mine, it's private, it's none of your business, it's none of the church's business, and it's probably none of God's business, because I worked hard for it. But Moses is trying to help us understand that the abilities that we have to earn the money that we have came from God. And therefore, what I earn as salary is based on talents that I have that were gifts to me from the Lord. And consequently, there is no cause for boasting. There's no cause for pride. It all comes back to God's gift to me. Or as Paul says in 1 Corinthians, chapter 4, verse 7, "What have you that you did not receive? If you then received it, why do you boast as if it were not a gift?" Why do we so brag, if you will, about our possessions? Or if we're too modest and polite to do that, why do we think we have greater worth if we have more things? And as you know, our culture even has come to the point of referring to what is your net worth. Not as a statement that you are of infinite worth because you have been redeemed by the Son of God, but a statement of what are your liquid or non-liquid assets. What have you got that you can sell? And how we've perverted the message. We try to keep money and faith separate. God says the two go together. Now, I was lied to in seminary. I was taught in seminary that Episcopalians do not like to talk about money. And I've come to understand that that is untrue. Episcopalians love to talk about money, but not in church. If you get Episcopalians at a cocktail party, they will love to talk and complain about the cost of living or this or that or the other. Did you know what they've done to the property taxes? But in church, no. We keep money and faith separate. But God says that our money decisions are spiritual decisions. What we do with our possessions affects our relationship with God. We try valiantly to keep God's hands off our pocketbooks. As some of you know, I love the illustration from medieval history of the tribes of Europe, who the Goths and Vandals and Visigoths and all of those groups, who were converted to Christianity through the missionary efforts of missionaries who went forth to preach the gospel. And you might well understand that most Visigoths were not converted by personal submission to the lordship of Jesus Christ after a one-on-one encounter with a missionary. They were converted because the head Visigoth was converted and thereby declared the whole Visigoth nation to be Christian, leaving the missionaries with a somewhat awkward liturgical exercise of trying to baptize 10,000 Visigoths at one shot. And so they would often say prayers of blessing over a river and have the whole army march through en masse for baptism. Now, you might appreciate that the pre-baptismal preparation for such an exercise would be sketchy at best. And their understanding of baptism was somewhat deficient. And they have a very primitive notion of baptism. They seem to think that what got wet got baptized. And so they would pull their swords, and they'd hold their swords high out of the water and march through the river, because they really believed that if they kept their fighting arm dry, then they wouldn't have to change the way they fought and waged war. If they kept their swords unbaptized, they wouldn't have to make any changes in their life. Their swords would become would remain unchristian. Well, it's been my experience in the Episcopal Church that a whole lot of us have gone through the waters of baptism with wallets held high out of the water. That we seem to have this notion that if we got our checkbooks wet, if God really baptized our wallets, there'd have to be some changes made. So our first line of defense is to rule the subject of money out of the discussion when we come to church. And one of the loudest protests you'll probably hear as you embark in stewardship education in your congregation is, we shouldn't be talking about this. This is private. This is nothing to do with the business of the vestry. We shouldn't be having this discussion. Not at all. God says that money decisions are spiritual decisions. The second step from that is that we are accountable to God for what we decide. He cares about the decisions that we make. If you look at Matthew 25, 14 to 30, the parable of the talents, the servants who are given 5 talents and 2 talents and 1 talent, and who come back, the 5 having been multiplied to 10, the 2 having been doubled to 4, but the one who had 1 talent was fearful of the hard master and came back and said, because you are a hard master, I buried it in the ground, and here is my 1 talent. And the message to him from the master is a hard one, that you wicked and slothful servant, you knew I reap where I have not sowed and gathered where I have not winnowed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has will more be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. There men will weep and gnash their teeth. It's a hard message. We are accountable before God for what we do with what he has entrusted to us. Our money decisions are spiritual decisions, and our money decisions matter. Now, we resist that like the plague. We like to think that God may have given us all that we have, but that we have thereby become owners, and that it is now ours, even if God gave it to us as a gift, it is now ours, and we have no responsibility before God with what we do with it. But God hasn't transferred the title, that we continue to be managers and not owners. We're accountable before him. There was a wonderful ad on television a while back in our area. Some of you may have seen it. For all I know, in this group, some of you may have been responsible for producing it. I have to be careful in groups in my own diocese. But it was an ad for one of our banks. And the ad was the lifetime of a little boy. And the ad starts with this little boy being delivered. And it's a very realistic delivery room scene. And the mother's there pushing, and the father's there all gowned up, and the doctors and nurses are all there. And this little boy is born. And he's held up. And the rest of the ad is a series of flash forwards of this little boy's life lived out under the care and concern and protection of the bank. And they hold up the little boy and they flash forward, and you see this little guy pedaling down the street throwing newspapers on lawns. And obviously you're thinking, you know, he's earning his first few pennies, passbook savings account, right? And then back to the delivery room, same little boy, and he's going forward and he's going off to some very swank looking college, obviously provided for by the loans and management of the bank. Back to the delivery room. And then he and his very attractive wife are stepping across the threshold of what is supposed to be their first house. And the mortgage department has come through, some house. And back to the delivery room, back and forth, back and forth. And they finally come to the end of this ad, and they show this very silver-haired gentleman with his very attractive wife standing at the helm of their yacht, sailing across the screen. And the tagline on this ad, I kid you not, this is a quote, is, our philosophy at such and such bank is that even though you came into this world with nothing, shows up the little boy, you shouldn't have to leave that way. Well, I learned it in Missouri, and Frank Foster, who did a stewardship workshop here many years ago, reminded us that there ain't no luggage racks on hearses. We are We are accountable before God for what we do with what he has entrusted to us. But there are consequences in our relationship with him for the right use of what he has entrusted to us. You look at Luke 12, 32-34. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give alms. Provide yourselves with purses that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Giving brings us closer to God. God has given us what we have, and in doing so has given us a tangible way of drawing closer to him by how we handle this material thing of money and possessions. We are able to be closer to him as we give back to him. Jesus' message about money and possessions can be summarized in 2 points. He says, on the one hand, that money can be the greatest asset we have in our relationship with God. Money is the greatest thing we have to deepen our experience of him. He says, if you want to be close to him, look at how you handle your money. And we see it in stories like the widow with her 2 tiny copper coins, the woman who shows more love for God with her little tiny gift than is shown in all the superficial gifts of the wealthy, the Good Samaritan, the one who stops by the side of the road and interrupts what I'm sure was a busy schedule. If you want a sermon text for the stewardship of time and talent, there's one right there. He cares for the one who is lying and beaten by the side of the road and takes him to the inn and has him fed and bandaged and cared for at his expense. And Jesus says that what he has done is what it means to love your neighbor. Or the story of Zacchaeus, the crooked tax collector, the little short guy who climbed the tree because he couldn't see Jesus. And he was so despised by everyone for being a chief tax collector that no one would have anything to do with him. No one accepted him except for his money. And Jesus comes through town and calls him down out of the tree and says, Zacchaeus, hurry down. I have to come to your house today. And before Zacchaeus has cleaned up his act at all, Jesus accepts him and loves him. And Zacchaeus is so overwhelmed by this unconditional love of Jesus in his life that he does amazing things. He says, today I give away half of all that I have. And if I have cheated anyone, one of the great scriptural understatements, he cheated everybody. If I have cheated anyone, he says, I repay them fourfold. He writes a check, if you will. And Jesus says, today salvation has come to this house. He gives his money. And Jesus, knowing where that comes from out of his heart, says, today salvation has come to this house. Money can be the greatest asset we have in taking that step toward the Lord. But there's a flip side to that. And Jesus says that also money can be the greatest threat to our experience of him. Money can get in the way of our relationship with God. And we know the story of the rich young ruler, the one who has kept the commandments, but says that he needs more to follow the Lord. What must I do? And Jesus says, go and sell what you have and give to the poor and come follow me. But he won't. He won't give up the possessions, and he goes away sorrowful, for he had many possessions. He couldn't have both his money and Jesus, and he chose his money. Money got in the way of him experiencing the kingdom that was offered to him. Or the story of the rich fool in his barns, the one who has got so much grain stored up in his barns that he can't think of a blooming thing to do with it except use it to tear down his barns to build bigger barns so he'll be safe and comfortable in his retirement, all the while neglecting his spiritual life. His security is in his possessions, as we indeed call them securities. And the message to him is, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and these possessions, whose will they be? And so it is with those who are rich but not rich toward God, Jesus says. Money can be the greatest threat to our relationship with God. But you and I have a problem with this. We have a big problem with it. And that is that you and I, in our heart of hearts, do not think that that message applies to us. Most of us, I suspect, can think of someone else who ought to be here to hear this. Someone else in our congregation has a spiritual problem with their money. And they really need to get in touch with this. And maybe I'll get a tape of this day and have them listen to it. But me? No. My problem with money isn't a spiritual one. My problem with money is just a practical one, and that is that I don't have enough of it. But Jesus says, whether we are as rich as the rich young ruler or as poor as the widow with her two copper coins, what we do with our possessions is a spiritual issue. Stewardship is not what would I do if. What would I do if Virginia gets a lottery and I hit it? Or what would I do if I really got the minimum salary for clergy in the diocese? Or what would I do if? It's not what would I do if. It's what would I do with what I have. God asks us to responsibly respond to him with what he has entrusted to us. I talk a lot about this, but I nailed myself recently in looking at other people's giving. I have to share this with you. One of my favorite magazines is a Christian satirical magazine called The Wittenberg Door. And every month they give out an award to the loser of the month. Their best foremost example of the distortion of the Christian gospel by Christians that they have come across. One month, just a few months back, my home parish in Missouri won the award for loser of the month. Giving it to an Episcopal church was exceptional. This is not a particularly Episcopal church magazine. And so I was struck by that. But they singled out the Lenten program of the parish for its interesting approach to the whole Lenten theme of self-denial and discipline and giving and penitence. Here are some of the topics of the Lenten series. It was sponsored by the one group in the parish for the whole parish. Here are some of the topics. Oriental rugs and today's world market. Noting the speaker will provide information about Oriental rugs, which give the owner a lifetime of service, pride in ownership, and will add opulence to any home decor. Appraisals of your valuables. That's the next week. You can bring an item of value and the appraiser will appraise it for you, but note he doesn't do rare books, manuscripts, or Japanese art. The do's and don'ts of real estate, and on and on and on. But when I read that, what I thought again was they have a spiritual problem with their possessions and they need to get in touch with it. And again, the whole thing hit me one more time. It's not that they do, it's that I do. And as soon as I see it in someone else, I need to realize that that's my issue as well. And God asks us to deal with ourselves. And that's going to come up again and again as we deal with leadership in our churches. But not to focus on the needs that they have to hear this message, but the need that I have to hear it and hear it again. When we give, as we respond to Jesus' message to put our treasure first and our heart will follow, I'd like to read to you words from John Westerhoff. Some of you know a noted Christian educator, friend of our bishop. He picks up on Jesus' message and challenges a great deal of what we often say in the church. John Westerhoff says, our material lives are important because they determine, as well as express, our spiritual lives. It is simply misleading to work on the assumption that if people are committed, they will give, and therefore to place our emphasis on seeking commitment. It is wiser to work on the assumption that if people give, they will become committed. We are more likely to act our way into a new way of thinking than to think our way into a new way of acting. Now, I think that has truth in it, but I want to take it one step beyond that. It has been my experience in the church that many, many people give, but you have to ask the question, to whom or to what are they giving? My experience is many, many people give to the church and become committed, therefore, to the church. Where their treasure is, their heart follows. And where their treasure is with the church. It is my belief that it is a false assumption to think that if someone's commitment is with the church, it is also with the Lord Jesus Christ. And I think that we have to look very carefully at a too glib acceptance of that notion, that if people are giving, they are thereby committed to the Lord. I don't think that always follows. I believe, however, that if people are indeed prayerfully giving to the Lord, they will become more committed to Him. I do indeed believe that. But I don't equate a large pledge, even a sacrificial pledge, with a commitment to God. And I think we have to deal in our own hearts and in our churches with the question of to whom or to what are we really giving? Okay. How do we respond more specifically? And we come, of course, to the issue of the standard of giving. We come to the question about the tithe. Deuteronomy 14, 22 and 23. I'll skip to the end of that second verse. You shall tithe all the yield of your seed which comes forth from the field year by year, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. One of the paraphrased versions of the Bible puts it, you shall tithe because tithing teaches you to put God first in your life, which I think in this case is a pretty good rendering of that. Tithing is where the rubber meets the road. Some of you may know the story of the two farmers who were discussing their church. And Hank turns to Fred and says, Fred, if you had 100 cows, would you give 10 to the Lord? Fred says, gee, I don't know, I never thought of it. Well, sure, I'd give 10 to the Lord. He says, great, if you had 100 sheep, would you give 10 to the Lord? Sure, he says, I'd give 10 to the Lord. He says, well, if you had 10 pigs, would you give one to the Lord? And he says, that's not fair. He says, what do you mean it's not fair? He says, you know I have 10 pigs. When we talk about tithing, it's when it gets real for us. It ceases to be lip service, which we can all learn. We can all learn all the right words about God as the author of all that I have and I give in thanksgiving. We can learn those words. At some point, though, we get down to reality of how do we act? How do we respond? I want to tell you a little bit about my story, not because my story is more important than anybody else, but perhaps you can identify with some of the issues involved. I got involved in stewardship the way I suspect a lot of you did, or the way a lot of you have got involved in other things in the church, and that is that I shot my mouth off once too often in a meeting and was put in charge. I was on the executive board of the diocese, and somebody was making some statements about stewardship education in the diocese and the need to tell the diocese that if they gave more money, we'd promise to send it all to the national church. And I thought that was somewhat deficient theologically and lacking something as a practical approach as well, and proceeded to say so with more vehemence than with eloquence. And the problem was the person I was disagreeing with was Bishop Hall, who in his wonderful, gentle way just smiled and looked over at me and appointed me a stewardship committee of one for the Diocese of Virginia. We had not had a stewardship committee in the diocese for some 6 or 7 or 8 years, and I was appointed a stewardship committee of one, told to carry out a stewardship education program for 167 churches in the next 90 days, and was given $50 with which to do it. Those were the good old days. And I, of course, panicked. I got on the phone to the National Church stewardship officers and screamed and begged for help. And they were polite but evasive, because the National Church stewardship staff and all the other National Church staff can only come to a diocese when they're invited. And here was I, an assistant in a parish, and who on earth is this guy? And certainly he's not speaking for the Diocese of Virginia. And they sort of said they need to check their calendars, and they would call me back. And I know they called the diocesan office, because they called it back about 5 minutes later. And I'm sure they were told, yes, we know, but he's the best we've got, because they were, when they called back, they couldn't have been nicer, and invited me to New York. And I blew 48 of my $50 on a shuttle ticket to New York and sat down in the office of Tom Carson and Harry Free, who were the two stewardship officers at the time, and said, help, we're broke in the Diocese of Virginia. At that point, giving to the Diocese of Virginia from the parishes had gone up a total of 12% in 12 years. And everybody was crying about money. And I said, we're broke, and I've got 167 churches, and I've got 90 days, and it's, the clock is running, and I've used 48 of my $50, and we need some help. And they said, gee, we really would like to help you. Tell us about your approach to stewardship. And I said, well, what I'm concerned about is we've got 167 churches and 90 days and no money and we're broke. And they said, yes, we understand that. But tell us about your stewardship and your approach. And I said, well, I'd really rather talk about we have 167 churches and we have no money. And they said, no, you got a problem. You need to talk about your stewardship. And at that point, I began to realize what the issue really was. And that is that I needed to deal with God's call on my own life. I needed to deal with my own stewardship before I or anybody else was going to be able to offer help to others. And that changed my life. You know, we talk all the time in the church about seek the giver and not the gift. And that's really what it's all about. Because those were two people who could have cared less about my gift. What I gave was not going to affect them directly or indirectly whatsoever. What they cared about was me, a timid, partially committed servant of Jesus Christ. And they challenged me to deal with myself. And I really began to hear the call from the Lord to tithe. Now, I'd heard about tithing. I'd been to seminary. But we learned how to come up with reasons not to deal with that. See, that in the normal human capacity to rationalize is of course quite impressive, but when you equip that normal natural human faculty with a theological education, the ability to explain to God why we don't need to respond is really quite significant and impressive. And I had lots of good reasons to tell God why I didn't need to do this, most of which boiled down to the fact that I was giving all of myself to God, therefore I didn't need to give my money. And my wife has also been to seminary, and as I came back and started to share my sense that we needed to deal with this, she thought I had absolutely lost touch with reality. But we began to pray about it, began to talk about it, and began we decided to move forward in our giving. Because what I really heard in my own prayers was that as much as I was giving my time, traveling all around and beginning to do stewardship work and giving my time for the church, as much as I really believed that God gave me the gifts that I have to do the ministry that I have, I came to realize that I was attempting to use time, talent, and treasure as interchangeable parts and to give the most convenient one at any given time. And I came to understand that there were indeed times in my life where I was willing to write a check as long as I didn't have to be involved with those kinds of people. And there were times when I was willing to be involved with people as long as it didn't affect my lifestyle. And that I was using both as a dodge from dealing with God's claim on my life. And so, in our family, we began to move forward in our own giving. And we began to work toward the tithe. And it got exciting. We began to make some real progress in that. And we moved in stages toward the tithe. And though money had not been the easiest subject for us to talk about, it got easier. And we began to look forward to conversations in the fall as to how much more we can give in the coming year. How much will we do? And as we came to that point where I was going to be making a tithe pledge on what I was earning, came to the point of moving to a new congregation, a mission church, for whom the counsel and advice of the bishop about the minimum salary was a new thought. And they were struggling with paying me, and I was struggling with that salary and the change and all that went into it. My wife was 7 months pregnant, going to be out of work for a period of time, and we were attempting to buy our first house. Interest rates were 18%. And we had said this was the time we were going to make the step to tithe. And though we'd made progress and experienced a tremendous amount of joy and release as we had moved forward, for me, all of a sudden, it all came back crashing down on me again. And it was like I had to make the decisions all over again and look one more time at how much do I really believe this? How much do I trust? And I don't know how to explain it. I can't talk about it without sounding corny, but I do know that we decided to go ahead and make that commitment to the tithe. and I never had a sleepless night about that mortgage. The kind of peace, the kind of freedom from anxiety about possessions that we experienced as we moved forward was something that I hadn't even been smart enough to ask for. And God has continued to touch us and free us up from that burden, that anxiety, that pressure, that tendency to evaluate ourselves based on what we have. Well, the more teaching and the more talking about stewardship I found myself doing, the more I began to find myself challenging myself without intending to. We talk often about the tithe as the minimum standard for Christian giving. And I would talk about that. And then one night, in the middle of teaching that in our own congregation, I had a little internal war going on. At which point I said to the group, the tithe is the minimum standard for Christian giving. At which point I said to myself, or perhaps indeed God said to me, through me, then why do you treat it as if it were the maximum? And I'd fallen into that trap of the tithe becoming a legalism in that when you get there, you have arrived, and you stick in your thumb and pull out a plum and say, what a good boy am I, and that I wouldn't have to deal with it anymore. And at that moment, I realized that I needed to continue to step forward. And so I'm in that place, and I share this not in any kind of prideful sense, but out of very real awareness of where I have come and how God has been gracious to me and has led me. We're to the point where we give 14% of what we earn to our parish church. And then other giving to other ministries beyond the parish, we do over and above that pledge to our parish. For me, that's 14% of it all. Housing allowance and utilities allowance and the whole nine yards. How you calculate that, I believe, is your business before God. I'll be happy to talk about that the second session. But for me, it has simply changed my life. To experience more and more what it means to put my faith into practice. My secretary, who is here from St. Margaret's Church, likes to tell me that she and her husband say, stewardship is what we do after we say we believe. And that's where it is. That's what it boils down to, is the so what of our faith. And for me, as God has called me forward, and I have at times fearfully, at times indeed joyfully responded to that, God has changed me in ways that are impossible for me to describe. But I am a different person because of what God has done in my life. And for me, that's what stewardship is all about. Now, there are lots of reasons to give, some of them not very exalted. God, I think, has one motive for giving, thankfulness. There are lots of other motives for giving, however, and we need to be on guard against them. The 116th Psalm, the 116th Psalm says, what shall I render to the Lord for all his bounty to me? The motive for Christian giving is thankfulness. Thankfulness. Not pride, not duty, not guilt, not fear, not because it's a good cause. The motive for Christian giving is thankfulness. I read in an airline magazine recently a story out of Miami, down one of the main streets in Miami, Flagler Street. There were a number of beautiful, tall, royal palm trees lining the street. And one night, vandals came and cut down six of the palm trees. And the city didn't have the money to replace them. And they thought they would just have to leave them bare in that spot. Until one day, finally, a donor came forward and offered to replace the trees at private expense. Whereas the former trees were 15 feet tall and provided a beautiful foreground to a big Delta Airlines billboard, the new palm trees were 35 feet tall and completely hid the billboard. The donor? Eastern Airlines. Lots of motives for giving. But let me venture a statement with you. I believe that if the motive that we are talking about in our churches is not thanksgiving to the Lord Jesus Christ, then what we are degenerating into is fundraising. If you are interested in raising funds, there are lots of ways of doing it. You know, you can see the ads in the magazines that you can feed this hungry child, or you can turn the page. You know, those kind of guilt-producing things. Most of us have schools of higher learning that are past masters at using most of the arm twist kinds of methods of raising money. Or we can talk about our thankfulness to the Lord God. And that, for me, is Christian giving. It is so easy to slip into those other methods, to talk about people's duty, that we have this responsibility to keep the church open. And do you know how much it costs to maintain this church every day? And do you know how much it costs to provide education for your children, and what this costs? And you have a responsibility. Some will respond to that. But if they respond, I don't think they will necessarily come one step closer to their Lord who created them. They may get closer to the church, but not necessarily closer to God. Jesus says the Gentiles love to be thought benefactors. In my experience, Episcopalians do too. If you can put a plaque on it, you can sell it in the Episcopal Church. There is a sense in which we can appeal to people's desire to feel generous. Even if you don't boast about it in the church, people indeed like to feel generous. And we can slip into that kind of payoff for our giving. Or perhaps the one that's most subtle is the good cause. There are important ministries that you need to support. And indeed, that is true. And we'll talk more about that in the next hour. But the first step has to be, why do I give? And once I'm clear about the fact that I give in thankfulness for what God has done in my life, then we can discuss what I will give to support. But first, we have to be clear about why we give. And then we'll talk about where that giving goes. So often we skip the motive and move immediately to the purpose of the giving, in which case the purpose becomes the motivator, and it brings people closer to that ministry, but not necessarily closer to the God who calls us to do that ministry. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 28. God tells us some of the benefits of obedience to his word. Be careful to heed all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and with your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. Give, obey, that it may go well with you. Now, I talk about this a great deal and got a good deal of static from people who said that that's pretty sloppy theology, John. And I went on one of the National Church Stewardship Conferences, and one of the resource persons for that workshop was a seminary professor of Old Testament who, without any prompting from me, picked up this passage and used it and explained that what God is saying to us is indeed that obedience to his command leads us into a quality of life that we would not know otherwise. It is not, in my view, a tit-for-tat kind of, if you give, you will thereby be promised to sell more insurance next year, and that your 90% giving post-tithe next year will exceed your 100% giving pre-tithe this year, as if God is some kind of cosmic E.F. Hutton that will automatically provide you a return on your investment. I know a church in Florida that promised its parishioners that if they tithed, God would promise to increase their salary post-tithe the following year. Money-back guarantee. Well, one guy tithed and he didn't get a raise, and he sued the church in court for breach of promise. And to some extent, I think the church deserved it, because I don't think that's what God talks about. I think God makes it very clear that he will meet our needs. But for a lot of us, one of the things that we're going to discover is the difference between our needs and our wants. And in my life, God has liberated me from a lot of wants that I used to call needs. I believe that God indeed does meet our needs. God calls us to follow his way because it is good for us. There are two kinds of laws in the universe. There are the kinds of laws that tell us what we should or should not do in order to avoid punishment. Drive 55 miles an hour on 95, or you will get a ticket. mail your Christmas packages early, or Cousin Matilda won't get her package and she'll be mad at you. Don't swing on 3-0 or the coach will bench you. They are not the immutable laws of the universe, but they're rules that tell you how to behave in this world. And then there are laws like the law of gravity and the second law of thermodynamics, which do indeed tell you how the universe functions. Most of us have a kind of early Sunday school notion that God's laws are the first kinds of laws, that God gives us do's and don'ts to spoil our fun, perhaps, but somehow will step in to reward or punish in a more or less kind of cavalier fashion in response to our behavior. In fact, God's laws are the second kind of laws. They are the way the universe operates. They are the principles by which He has created this world and under which it runs. And that if we care about our spiritual well-being, we'll pay attention to His advice to us, just as if we care about our physical well-being, we'll pay attention to the law of gravity. The law of gravity doesn't say if you go up on the top of this church and jump off, please fall. And if you don't fall, you're going to get in trouble. It says if you jump off, you will fall, and you're probably going to get hurt. And God tells us things like don't commit adultery, not because he's trying to ruin our good times or because he's going to step in arbitrarily and mess up our lives, but because he has told us that it is spiritually, if not physically, destructive for us to do that. And that there are necessary consequences of our behavior. And what God tells us is that in the realm of giving as well, there are consequences for our behavior, for good or ill. And He loves us so much that He wants us to know what it is that we can do that will draw us closer to Him. Not because He is going to arbitrarily punish us or zap us if we disobey, not at all. But rather because He knows what is life-giving for us. And He sends Jesus that we might have life and have it abundantly. And He wants us to know how to live into that abundant life. And so He calls us to obedience to Him, to follow His call. And in my own life, I struggle with that. And as a friend of mine put it to me when I was commenting about my struggle, she said, you know, John, the definition of struggle is postponed obedience. And I went, ouch. Because so often I justify my continuing struggle when I know clearly what God is calling me to do, and I resist accepting that claim that God has on my life. God calls us to respond so that it may go well with us, so that we will know a joy that comes only in drawing close to Him. And He also tells us some good that comes from our giving for the sake of others. Deuteronomy 15. Deuteronomy 15, 10 and 11. You shall give to your poor brother freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him. Because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake. For the poor will never cease out of the land. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in the land. God calls us to give because it will change us. And give because it will also meet the needs of those around us. And how often that passage is quoted, sadly, out of context, the poor we will have always with us, as if that justifies non-response to their condition. It's clearly a statement that we must respond because the poor will never cease out of the land. God cares about what we do with what we give. But it comes first out of thankful hearts and then is used by God to bless and touch and change others as well. But we need to know first and foremost why we give. What happens in our lives when we respond? I've been touched a long time ago by the illustration from the Holy Land geography. Some of you may have seen this a long time ago. If you know the river that starts down the Holy Land, it's what? The Jordan River. And it empties at the top of the Holy Land in your mind's eye on the map into what lake? Right, the Sea of Galilee. Then the River Jordan comes down and empties into what?
Right.
the Dead Sea. Some of you have been to the Holy Land, have better Holy Land geography than I. But the Sea of Galilee is of still a beautiful, fish-filled, pristine lake. The Dead Sea is, as its name implies, dead. Nothing lives in it, nothing lives around it, birds won't even fly over it. It is so dead. But the amazing thing for me is that it is exactly the same Jordan River that feeds both lakes. The Jordan River flows into both lakes. The difference is the Sea of Galilee takes the water in at one end and lets it out at the other. And the Dead Sea takes it in and keeps it all. The love of God has been given to each one of us. There is no sense in which any of us have been more loved by God than another one. And yet the issue for us is not have we received God's love, but do we receive what God has for us and hold on to it? Or do we receive it and let it flow through us? If we try to hold on to it, there is death. If we let it come through us to others, there's life and abundance. If you imagine two people responding to this or some other stewardship program, perhaps in your parish, and two people walk out and say, well, that's kind of interesting. I think in response to that, next year in my giving to the Lord, I'm going to give $100. And someone else says, of the same income, I'm going to give $10,000. Which one does God love more? Trick question. Because God loves them both the same. God loves them both completely. God loves them both perfectly. There is nothing in this world that we can do that is going to make God love us any less. And there is nothing we can do with our giving that's going to make God love us any more. And I want to make it clear that we are not talking about a give and give in a certain way in order to get God love you sort of theology. It is rather a matter of give because God already loves us. And we experience what God has for us when we give as he asks us to. There's a wonderful story about a small church that was always in desperate search for supply clergy to handle its Sunday services. And they would often have to fend around to find a different priest each week to come in and do services. One priest had been invited to come in and lead their worship and arrived quite a bit early. No one was in the church, and he came in the back and poked around, and he read the bulletin board, and he read the track rack, and then finally he noticed a little box on the back wall, and he naturally assumed that that was a box for offerings for the poor. So he reached into his pocket and pulled out a couple of quarters and popped them in the box. A short time later, the senior warden arrived and came up and welcomed the priest to the church, said, we're glad to have you here, and we do the service in this sort of way, and we vest over here, and I'll talk to you after the service. So after the service, the senior warden comes up to him and says, gosh, it's just been wonderful having you here. Your sermon was marvelous. We'd love to have you here every week. But he said, I'm embarrassed to tell you this. We are just a poor country church, and we don't have any money to pay our guest preachers. But we have a system in our church. All our people know that they can put money in a little box we have in the back of the church to pay our preachers. And I know after your sermon today, there's just going to be a lot of money in that box. So he pulls out a little warden's key and goes to the back of the church and opens up the box, and out falls 50 cents. And it's all the guy can do to not burst out laughing in the poor warden's face. And he goes home and he is regaling his family with this story over Sunday dinner. And they're all chortling over it until his 11-year-old son pops up and says, Dad, you don't understand. If you'd have put more in, you'd have gotten more out. Jesus says that if we seek to save our lives, we will lose them. If we lose our lives for his sake and the gospel's, we'll find them. Or if you put more in, you get more out. Talked about this morning into practice, and in particular things that we can do in practice that do not undermine what we talked about in the first hour. And I think unfortunately that is often the case, that we do things that subvert the good effort that goes on in terms of educating people about the biblical message of stewardship. It's long been my contention in this diocese that many of our churches operate in stewardship on the practical principle that has come to be known as the Moose Principle. And that is based on this wonderful story of two hunters who went up in the Canadian wilderness to shoot moose. They chartered a little one-engine plane and were taken into a little landing strip, dropped off, and the pilot told them, "I'll pick you up in a week, and I can take the two of you out in one moose. See you in a week," and he buzzes off. Week later, the pilot comes back in with the plane, and there at the end of the runway are two hunters and two enormous moose. And the pilot looks out and says, "Hey guys, I can't take two moose. We'll never get up in the air." And the hunters are crestfallen. They say, "Hey look, we worked so hard to get these two moose, and our families are never going to believe we got two if we don't take them both back. And besides, last year, we were in a plane exactly the same size, and the pilot let us take two moose." And the pilot says, "Well, I guess if he let you do it last year, we can do it this year. Let's go." So they pile the hunters and the moose in the plane, and they take off, and they go down the runway, just shudder down the runway, just barely lift off, just clear the trees, and crash into the side of the mountain. Airplane everywhere, moose everywhere. And these two hunters stagger out of the plane and look around, and one of them in a fog says, "Where are we?" And the other one looks out and he says, "Well, I think we got about a half a mile farther than we did last year." Our churches, when it comes time to a stewardship education program, crank it up one more time, not really expecting that we're going to get off the ground, but maybe we'll get a half a mile farther down the mountain before we crash. I want to talk about a leadership principle for Christian stewardship. It's my conviction that the stewardship commitment of a congregation will never exceed the stewardship commitment of its leadership. That is to say, of its clergy and vestry. Stewardship commitment of a congregation will never exceed the stewardship commitment of its clergy and vestry leadership. Now, I do not mean that in any kind of crass, dollar-for-dollar average pledge kind of fashion, but in terms of what the commitment is in the part of the leadership. Most of us, indeed, follow our leaders, and most people in the congregation follow their leaders. Now, I have taught that principle for a good long time, and I've come to realize that it's only partially true. I need to amend it. And what it should be amended to read is, the stewardship commitment of a congregation will never exceed the communicated stewardship leadership of its clergy and vestry. The communicated leadership is crucial, because in my experience, there are an awful lot of closet tithers out there, people who have experienced tremendous joy in their own life, but have simply never shared it with others. I worked in a congregation one point and was sharing with the vestry some of my experiences in my own life about giving and talking with the vestry and inviting them to share with one another. And they were just buzzing with excitement that they had never heard this before, and it was challenging and stimulating, and that they had long felt that somehow God ought to be a part of their money decisions. And at that point, the rector stopped the meeting and very quietly looked around the room. And he said, "That you all know that I have been your rector for, lo, these many years, and I love you all very much. And now, as I am about to retire," he said, "I have come tonight to realize for the first time how much I have failed you as your priest." Because, he said, "I've been a tither for 44 years, and I don't think I've ever told a soul in this church how much it means to me." There is a need for leadership in the church from the clergy and from the vestry about stewardship and about the personal commitment and giving of the leaders of the church. I was again taught in seminary that it was a virtue to be able to say that the clergy in this church don't talk about money. We have the lay people do that. I would invite you, as you make such statements about the role of clergy, for example, in teaching and preaching about stewardship, to substitute for the word stewardship or giving or money, substitute the word prayer and see how it sounds. As in, "Well, in our church, we don't have the clergy talk about prayer. We have lay people do that." Well, I think it's great to have lay people talk about prayer, just as it is great to have lay people talk about stewardship and money and all the issues related to that. But if the clergy were explicitly avoiding the subject of prayer, I would raise a question: what's going on in the prayer life of the rector? And I'm afraid to say that a lot of times that we, the clergy, have not really dealt with what's going on in our own stewardships to the point where we feel comfortable talking about it in our own congregations. There's a leadership principle at work, and the people of the parish need to hear from their leaders. It's uncomfortable, there's no question about it, to become more open about what God has done in our own life and our response. There's a wonderful story of a college professor who was giving a large lecture class, one of those 500-seat rooms. Came time for the final exam, handed out the exam and said, "Class, you will have 2 hours to complete this test. At the end of the 2 hours, I will collect your papers, and under no circumstances will any papers be accepted after the deadline. You may begin." 2 hours later, the professor said, "Time's up, papers in now." Thunder of people came forward to pile up the papers, this enormous pile of papers on his desk. In the very back of the room, one guy just continues to write, furiously keeping writing. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes goes by, and he's still writing. Finally, he comes forward with his papers clutched up behind his back to the desk. And the professor looks at him and says, "I'm sorry, I won't accept your paper. It's late. I said I wouldn't accept any late papers." And the student said, "Professor, do you know who I am?" And the professor said, "No, I don't." And the student said, "Great," and shoved his exam in the middle of the pile. Around stewardship time, my experience is that a lot of clergy would love to head for the middle of the pile. We would love not to be somehow on the spot to lead. I think in some measure the reticence that we have as clergy goes back to that issue of the motive for giving. If the motive for giving is to raise the budget, then indeed it is probably appropriate for the clergy to be reticent about taking a part in the raising of it, because so much of it goes to the salary of the clergy. But if the motive is thanksgiving, then the clergy need to be thankful as much as everyone else. We need to give as much as everyone else. And we need to be open about saying that that is why we give. And I think one of the most effective ways that the clergy can talk about the purpose of stewardship is not fundraising for the budget, is to witness to their own giving, however minimal or committed that might be. To say, "This is where I am, and here is where I want to be in my giving." To be open, to be honest, to be vulnerable about that before the congregation. To do that regularly. My experience, again, is that most clergy do not talk about their annual prayer sermon as if it were the one sermon that they advertise in advance so that people who can decide whether or not to come based on how much they want to hear the rector's prayer sermon. I know clergy who have concluded their stewardship sermon began the sermon with an apology for making the sermon and concluded it with the words, "Thank you for listening." The kind of queasiness about this aspect of the gospel, that somehow it is inappropriate that we talk about this, that money and faith really should be separate, but unfortunately we have to pay the bills, so we have to talk about it today. I think that stewardship needs to be preached about routinely. One of the workshops this afternoon is about preaching on stewardship, and we can talk more in that context about how we can do that. But when we first began talking intensively about stewardship in our congregation, I made a point of dealing with stewardship issues at least 6 times a year and dealt with them routinely. Perhaps stewardship not as, "This is the sermon on money and I'm going to lay it on them in one dose," but it would come up when it came up. And if the sermon was about commitment and how we struggle to be more committed in our lives, talking about possessions, for example, might be point two of a 3-point sermon that talked about other aspects of life, of commitment in it. Stewardship needs to be a routine element that doesn't get so elevated that it becomes that controversial subject that no one wants to talk about, and then when you talk about it, you've got to flat lay it on them because this is your one chance. It needs to be routine. However, clergy need to be supported in that by their lay leaders, because if the clergy indeed start talking more about stewardship issues from the pulpit, Some will say, that's inappropriate. Why is he talking about money so much? And the clergy need to be supported by the vestry and the stewardship leadership in the parish to say, because we asked the rector to talk about it more.